All right, tonight, class, we begin our review of the planets, and we're going to begin by looking at the terrestrial planets. These are kind of Earth-like, they're solid, they're kind of metallic instead of gaseous. In the following chapter, we'll look at the gas giants, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. For this chapter, which we'll begin tonight and cover next week, we're looking at the first four planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars. And this is a good diagram showing the relative sizes of the planets. And you see the rocky planets, the terrestrial planets, are very small in compared to those gas giant planets, Jupiter being the largest. The volume of Jupiter is over 1,400 times greater than the volume of Earth. If they were both empty spheres and you'd fill the Earth with water, you would have to do so 1,400 times to fill up the sphere of Jupiter. It's 318 times more massive than the Earth. Now, Pluto has been demoted down here, and we'll look at that story later this evening, to a dwarf planet. Now, here's a description of the Roman gods after whom the planets were named. And, you know, when the ancients looked at the celestial sphere, as we have seen in a previous chapter, they saw the background stars all moving across the sky from east to west in a kind of a fixed order. The stars never changed position relative to each other. They rose and they set, but they all moved at the same relative speed, unlike the planets. The ancients noted immediately that there were certain objects that defied that principle that moved at a different speed relative to the background stars. And they gave those objects the name planetes in Greek, from which we get our word planet. And there were seven of them: the Sun, the Moon, Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. They didn't know that Uranus, Neptune, Pluto existed. And so, under the geocentric view of Ptolemy, the Earth was the center. It was geocentric. The Earth was the center of the universe, and everything rotated about us. So the Earth was not considered to be a planet under that conception. But all of those other seven objects that seemed to move at a different rate than the background stars were considered to be planets. And the Greeks named them after their gods, using Romanized Latin names. That's become the convention. So, for example, the Moon in Latin, Luna in Greek, Selene, the planet Mercury from the Latin Mercurius in Greek, that god was known as Hermes. Venus was Venus in Latin, Aphrodite in Greek. The Sun was Sol in Latin, Helios in Greek. Mars was Mars in Latin, Ares in Greek. You'll recognize Ares from Acts chapter 17, when the Apostle Paul appears on Areopagus, Mars Hill, and he speaks to the philosophers. In fact, he sees the statues to their many gods, including one to an unknown god. And he declares to the philosophers, "The god who you have said is unknown, I am here to declare to you." A very bright star that we'll see during our star parties is Antares. It's the second brightest red object in the sky. The first brightest is the planet Mars. Noticeably red. But Antares is a supergiant red star, probably 100 million times bigger than our Sun. In fact, its orbit would subsume, its circumference would probably subsume the entire orbit of the Earth, if not Mars. So it's a giant Sun, but it just appears as a small dot in the sky because it's so far away. But it's called Antares because it's anti-Aries, or, you know, the rival of Aries, Mars. Jupiter was Jupiter to the Romans, Zeus to the Greeks, and Saturn, Saturnus to the Romans, and Kronos to the Greeks. Now, the Greeks had this conception that the seven gods, these particular seven gods after whom the planets were named, took hourly shifts watching over the Earth. It was a kind of a paternalistic notion. And the 7 days of the week then were named after the god with the first hour of duty on each of those 7 days. And so we see here that Sunday was named after the sun, Monday after the moon, Saturday after Saturn, and the remaining 4 days were not named after Roman gods, but named after their Anglo-Saxon equivalent. So, for example, Tuesday was Tu, Anglo-Saxon equivalent to Mars, Wednesday, Woden, Thursday, Thunor, and Friday, Friggi, from the Anglo-Saxon equivalent to Venus. Now, up until the 17th century, there was no such thing as a solar system. You know, the solar system refers to the heliocentric conception of the sun as the center of our planetary system, consisting of 8 planets, various asteroids, and dwarf planets, comets, etc. But up until the 17th century, the geocentric theory prevailed, and the Earth was the center of everything, and everything rotated about us. There was no solar system, just one universe with the Earth at the center and the Earth not being a planet. From the 17th century forward, probably starting 50 to 60 years after Copernicus, largely due to the work of Galileo, the heliocentric model is slowly adopted. And as a result, the sun was then seen as the center of the solar system, what was called the universe. At that point, and for centuries afterwards, there was no concept of other galaxies. All planets orbit the sun. The Earth is a planet, just like those other planets. The sun and moon are not planets. They were demoted, if you can say that, from that list of planets. Anything that orbits the sun under this conception was a planet. As a result, it's interesting to note that several asteroids were classified as planets in the early 19th century and remained so up until the middle of the 19th century, such as Ceres, Pallas, Juno, and Vesta. By the mid-19th century, astronomers were able to determine from their more sophisticated astronomical observations that many of these so-called new planets were very much unlike the remaining planets. They were all in the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. And number two, they were very small in size, significantly smaller than the other planets. The new planets were reclassified as asteroids. Most were located in that belt between Mars and Jupiter. It's very rich in asteroids. And yet, the total combined mass of all of the asteroids in that belt still would comprise just a small fraction of our moon, for example. Yet, there's enough mass there that it was of some concern to NASA when they launched the Voyager spacecraft and the Pioneer spacecraft. They launched them both as duplicate spacecraft for fear that one of them would be destroyed by striking an asteroid while they were traversing the asteroid belt. It did not happen. Planet was, in the mid-19th century, reclassified as any large body orbiting the sun. Large body, let me emphasize. 1930, Pluto was discovered by Clyde Tombaugh, Kansas farm boy, who built his first telescope using directions included in a Sunday school quarterly magazine. And he becomes an avid amateur astronomer, is hired without a college degree, any education at all, by the Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona, where just a few years later, at about age 20 or 21, as I recall, he is the first person since some time to discover a planet, and he discovers Pluto. We'll talk about that incredible discovery in the next chapter. Well, in 1930, when Tombaugh discovers Pluto, this newly formed International Astronomical Union, consisting of professional astronomers from most countries on Earth, originally believed, based on sketchy initial evidence, that Pluto was 1 to 2 times bigger than the Earth. And based on that erroneous conception, it was classified as a planet. Some years later, it was determined to have the mass of only 2/1000ths that of Earth, smaller than the moon, than our moon. So do we really want to conceive of that as a planet? Well, in the 1990s, astronomers discover thousands of Pluto-type objects having similar orbits and what are called trans-Neptunian objects that we'll look at in a later chapter. in what is commonly referred to as the Kuiper Belt. 30 to 45 astronomical units from the Sun. 2005, the discovery of Eris, the Greek god of strife and contention, appropriately named because it was the discovery of this object that was initially classified by the IAU as a planet that caused astronomers around the world to say, hey, wait a minute, do we really want to call this thing a planet? And for several months, it was deemed a planet. In fact, there were many newspaper articles referring to it as the 10th planet, the planet after Pluto. Here's its trajectory. Look at these nearly circular orbits. Look at how eccentric Eris is. Pluto's year is about 250 years. 1 year for Eris is 557 years. Its eccentricity, 0.44, inclination, 44 degrees compared to the plane of the solar system. This was a really very irregular object. Do we really want to include this in the list of planets? Well, how could we not include that, but include Pluto? What is the basis for differentiation? So the International Astronomical Union, at its meeting at the end of 2006, addressed this issue. And here's the current definition. This group, by the way, the IAU, meets every 3 years somewhere around the world. I think the last meeting was in Baltimore, Maryland, in the United States, and that was about 15, 20 years ago. So they meet in different nations, different capitals, and this was the definition of planet they came up with in 2006. A planet is a celestial body that satisfies three things. Number one, it's in orbit around the sun. Number two, it has sufficient mass for its self-gravity to overcome rigid body forces so that it assumes a hydrostatic equilibrium, meaning a nearly round or spherical shape. And number three, it has substantially cleared the neighborhood around its orbit. Not completely, because Neptune has not cleared its orbit, because its orbit intersects Pluto's. And we don't want to demote Pluto or Neptune. So it has substantially cleared the neighborhood around its orbit. That's the current definition of a planet. Under this definition, Pluto does not qualify. There are eight planets. Bodies that satisfy the first two conditions and are not satellites of another planet are now called dwarf planets. And that is what Pluto is now defined as being, in addition to Ceres and Eris. There are several other objects, by the way, that are currently under consideration. There has been a lot of criticism of the demotion of Pluto and with the concept of dwarf planets. Here's a schematic showing the relative sizes of several of these trans-Neptunian objects. These are objects beyond the orbit of Neptune, including Pluto. Here's Pluto. And as we can see, and one of its moons, it actually has three, the other two are quite small. Eris is actually larger than Pluto, and it has a moon. And then you have these other trans-Neptunian objects that have been discovered, many of which were probably going to be planets. There were some that thought that we'd have 20 or 30 planets until the IAU came up with this final definition that kept the classical planet list to eight, and came up with this subcategory of dwarf planets. Here is Ceres, just to show you, in comparison, it only has 4% of the mass of our moon. Do we want that to be a planet? If so, what about the moons of Jupiter? Over 60 moons, many of them are bigger than this, than Ceres. And our own moon, several of the moons of Saturn are bigger than Ceres. So again, how can we have planets that are smaller than some of the satellites of some of the classical planets? That was one of the issues. Let's take a look at some of the former planets. Well, the Sun, that's a former planet, just like Pluto. That was considered a planet from ancient times up until the 1600s. Why? Because it was orbiting the Earth under the geocentric model. The Moon was considered a planet because it again was in a sphere orbiting the Earth like everything else in the heavens and was considered a planet, no different than Mars or Jupiter. Ceres was a planet from its discovery in 1801 until it was demoted at about the time Sherman reached Atlanta in 1864. Where is its region? Location in the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. There's a vast difference between, when you look at the distances of the terrestrial planets, the Earth is about 93 million miles from the Sun. Mars, it varies, but you're looking at maybe 120 million. And then you jump to Jupiter, which is 500 million. So there's a vast chasm between those planets that is filled partially by the asteroid belt. Some have initially speculated it was a planet that has disintegrated. Absolutely false, because the mass of all of that debris, as I said, is a tiny fraction of our moon. Ceres has yet to be, I think hypothetically, it may be a dwarf planet. It may be demoted to an asteroid. Its status as of today is in doubt. Pallas, discovered in 1802, since it was an object orbiting the sun at a time when it was difficult to measure the mass of objects, that was considered a planet for 62 years, again, until the last year of the Civil War, the American Civil War, 1864. It is now considered an asteroid. Juno, discovered, 1804, demoted in 1864 to an asteroid. Vesta, discovered, 1807, considered a planet until 1864. So look at that. In 18, when Abraham Lincoln takes office as president of the United States, all four of these objects were considered planets. However, Neptune had not been discovered, nor had Pluto. So it was a very different configuration, wasn't it? A very different understanding of planets. And then Pluto, discovered by Clyde Tombaugh in 1930, and remained a planet till 2006. It's in that Kuiper belt, and it is now considered a dwarf planet. Clyde Tombaugh, by the way, died in the mid-90s. His widow is still living. She's like 97 years old. And his ashes were placed on the New Horizons spacecraft that launched about a year ago for Pluto. Okay, let's shift our focus here and start talking about the inferior planets. When we use the term inferior planet, we're not talking about less significant, although they are obviously much smaller. But we're talking about, some of them are anyway, we're talking about planets that are closer to the sun than the Earth. And there are two of them, Venus and Mercury. It's interesting, when you look at Venus, which is clearly visible in the western sky at sunset now, and for an hour or two after sunset, that bright object just above the western horizon, that's the planet Venus. If you track Venus, the point is, inferior planets never rise to straight overhead. They can't, if you look at the trajectory of their orbits. Since they're closer to the sun than we are, they can never traverse the entire arc of the sky. But rather, they seem to go up in the sky shortly after sunset or shortly before sun up, and then they go back down. That's true for Mercury. That's true for Venus. That was a strange and bizarre, irregular anomaly that the geocentric theory could not adequately explain. But it's easily explained under the heliocentric Copernican model. And, of course, the death knell was Galileo looking at Venus through a telescope and discovering that it went through phases. The only way to explain that is with the heliocentric model. Okay, here are the four terrestrial planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, shown to scale here. So these are the actual sizes in relationship to the Earth. And as we can see, well, you know, Venus kind of looks a little bigger than Earth there, doesn't it? In fact, it's only about 95% of the diameter of Earth. Earth is actually slightly bigger diameter than Venus, and it's substantially bigger than either Mercury or Mars. Again, I think Mars is a little bit inflated here in terms of its size, because the Earth, if we use the Earth's diameter as our benchmark of 1, Mercury is about a third, about 40%. Venus is about 95% the diameter of the Earth. Mars about half. So you see that's, I think, a little bit larger than it should appear. Our moon is about 25%. And by comparison, Jupiter is 11.2%. In terms of the mass of those terrestrial planets, and then throwing Jupiter and the moon in just for comparison purposes, because only these first four would be the terrestrial planets, you've got Mercury at about 0.05 of the mass, 5% of the mass of the Earth. Venus is about 0.086. Mars, 0.11, 11%. The moon, 0.012 of the mass of the Earth, and Jupiter, 318 times. Then you can look at the volume in this next column. And you see Venus is very similar to the Earth, about 85% the volume. Mars is only 15% the volume. The moon, 2%. Jupiter, 1,400 times. Just to give you a kind of a sense of the relative sizes of these planets. All right? How do the planets form? It's not clearly understood how planets have formed. There have been many theories, many models as to how they have formed. I'll just go over quickly here tonight the standard model that is by no means accepted by all astronomers, but I would say that if you would poll all professional astronomers in the United States, in the world for that matter, I think the consensus would be that based on our best understanding today, the best evidence, the accretion model is the best explanation of how the planets formed. And you begin with a supernova eruption. We'll look at this in a future chapter in much more detail. But the current model stipulates that after the creation of the universe, the only elements created were hydrogen and some helium. No heavy elements. Where did the heavy elements come from? Everything heavier than helium, what are called metals. Everything heavier than helium basically is considered a metal. The only way that much of this can be developed is through supernova explosions. As we'll see when we look at the life cycle of stars, you can produce certain other elements, such as carbon and oxygen, silicon, etc. Elements heavier than iron on the periodic table can only be created through supernova explosions. These are cataclysmic eruptions of a star, a large star, much larger than our Earth. And only in that way is there enough heat produced to cause the fusion necessary to create the heavier elements. So under the current model, a supernova eruption occurs that seeds the space around it with these heavy elements that are formed in that cataclysmic explosion. And then hydrogen clumps, regroup, coalesce to form stars. And those stars are then surrounded by disks of dust, gas, and rocks. These are all in orbit around this new star and constantly colliding with each other, forming bigger and bigger accretions, like snowballs being added to, and these collisions cause intense heat that make them plastic or malleable, and so when they're struck by another object, they tend to be absorbed rather than to deflect them. And so this process of continual impacts create planetoids and then eventually larger planets, and at the same time, they clear the orbit of this kind of debris. The evidence for this would be the surface of the terrestrial planets and moons, as we've seen how completely geologically active these things have been, with all of those impact craters on objects that do not have atmospheres, such as our moon. And then the Kuiper Belt, which remains as a belt in our solar system between the Mars and Jupiter, as we've seen, that consists of just countless small objects. And so here's an artist's depiction of what the early solar system looked like with all of this junk rotating around the sun and small objects colliding with other objects and forming bigger objects. And the bigger they get, the more gravitational attraction they have, and they attract more things to them. This is the current model. And again, here's the surface of Mercury, for example. This is a geologically active environment. And when you look at the cratering there, which, again, we have seen no craters formed since the history of the telescope, where did all these come from? There was the solar system was intensely active. And we see here when we look at the moon, and we'll talk about this later, but you look at craters and they come in all different sizes and all different levels of erosion. And there's a whole science of estimating the age of craters based on erosion. Keep in mind, the moon has no atmosphere, no wind, no water to cause erosion. So erosion is an exceedingly slow process. And yet, we see relatively recent cratering. We see some evidence of craters that are just barely visible because they've eroded out of existence. Okay, let's shift our focus here to the planet Earth. And then we'll come back, we'll talk about the Earth-Moon system, then we'll come back and look at Mercury and Venus and then Mars. Here's a picture taken by one of the Apollo missions of Earthrise over the moon. Fantastic image. This is that picture we've seen before, taken by the Galileo spacecraft, one of the first images to show the Earth and moon in the same photograph. Now here's a cross-section of the Earth, according to our current understanding of geology. And I think the things to keep in mind here for our purposes are, number one, the principal layers. First of all, being the crust, which goes down to 20 or so miles deep. It varies from place to place. And then the mantle from 20 to 22 miles down to about 1,800 miles, this region right here. And then after that comes the outer core, and that goes from about 1,800 to 3,200 miles, and that's followed by the inner core, which is 3,200 to 4,000 miles. It gets, each one of these strata can be divided into further levels, as we see here. You've got the lithosphere, etc. I'm not concerned about knowing that, but I do think it's helpful to have some understanding of this basic structure right here, the crust, the mantle, the outer core, and the inner core. And I think it's important to note that this outer core here, the 1,800 to 3,200 miles, this is considered to be molten metal, whereas the inner core is considered to be solid metal. And as the Earth rotates, the outer core of molten metal is rotating at a different rate than the Earth is. And this causes some chaos in the magnetic fields. And in fact, there's strong evidence to indicate that the Earth's magnetic fields have flipped several times in history. Here we see the solid inner core. It's like a shot put. Much of it is iron, rotating at a faster speed than the planet itself, at a different speed than the planet itself, which may be part of the explanation, as we see in this article, for magnetic pole flips. You know, magnets are very interesting things, aren't they? Just think about it. If you have a bar magnet and you cut the bottom part off, the top of that becomes the north of a new magnet. How does it do that? Kind of an interesting conception. Question? The Earth's core is segregated by a process called differentiation, as you'd expect, with the densest materials or heaviest elements in the center. The inner core, basically, as I say, is a shot put of solid iron, surrounded by the liquid core, the outer core, of liquid iron and sulfur because of the temperature. The mantle, magnesium, iron, aluminum, silicon, oxygen. The mantle is considered a plastic layer, permeable. It is movable, but it's not in a liquid state. And then the hard crust, which is rocky, largely silicates. The current understanding is, the current model, is that this geothermal energy warms the mantle, making it plastic and not liquid. And there are these huge chunks of the Earth's crust called plates or tectonic plates that literally float on that plastic mantle. This, among other things, produces continental drift. Continentals are drifting at about the same rate of speed as your fingernails grow. It's a process that takes an exceedingly long period of time. Some have speculated that in eons past, their continents were together in a in a primordial continent called Pangaea. Here's a depiction of what that might have looked like with all the continents fused together. Anyway, here's this great animation showing the so-called Pangaea separating into the modern continents. Still speculation, but there's a lot of support for this. Here are the fault lines, these red lines on this map of the Earth. These red lines are the fault lines along which volcanoes and earthquakes typically occur. These lines are associated with higher gravity because of the subterranean matter like magma that pushes its way up through the crust and forms ridges and mountains under the sea or mountains above sea level. And there's greater gravity because there's greater mass. And so here we see these lines, and from outer space, satellites can actually detect these fault lines by looking at differences in elevation of the water. The ocean's water is maybe a few meters higher along the fault lines than it is elsewhere on the surface of the ocean. Here's another depiction of the fault lines showing past or present volcanoes. There's the so-called Ring of Fire all the way through South Asia. Up around, look at Japan, all the islands are literally red. And then coming up through the Bering Straits, Alaska, one of the greatest earthquakes in the 20th century happened there. And then down the western coast of the United States, down here across Central America, all the way down South America. Not nearly as much, although here across the middle of the Atlantic, we see another fault line. And these are where earthquakes and volcanoes, the red dots indicate the epicenters greater than a 5 from 1980 to 1990. Okay, let's take a look at the next topic, and that's ocean tides. Anybody that's lived at the ocean or visited the ocean, you immediately become aware of the fact that the ocean levels vary throughout the day. In fact, they do so with a very predictable pattern, so much so that you can read in the local papers what high tide and what low tide is going to be on any given day. Well, it was not until Isaac Newton in the late 17th century that we had a clear understanding of what caused tides. In fact, it turns out it is a very complex phenomenon to understand fully. We can understand the basic concept pretty easily, but there are many permutations or there are many aspects of tides that are very difficult to explain. So we're just going to cover, I think, the high points here. The basic mechanism of tides is the gravitational attraction of the moon and the sun. And so here we see during a full moon, when the moon is on this side of the Earth and it's full at sunset, this is a syzygy as we've seen before, the moon is literally pulling the water more than it is the Earth because the ocean water is closer to the moon than the Earth is. Similarly, on the other side, the sun is exerting some gravitational influence on the water, much more than the Earth. Also, the moon, which actually is exerting a greater gravitational power, not a gravitational force, because the gravitational force of the sun, even though it's 390 times farther away than the moon, is still a greater gravitational attraction. But there's something called the gravitational gradient, which is a vector analysis, which is far more sophisticated than we're going to get into here, results in the moon having, in effect, a greater attraction. And that's why you see the bulge here a little bit thicker than you do on this side. When the moon is at first or third quarter phase, then you have what's called neap tide as opposed to spring tide. And spring has nothing to do with spring during the year, but it means leaping upward or, you know, the higher tide. And that happens at full moon and new moon when the spring tide is at its greatest extent. So here we see a depiction of a low tide here, which would be point B in this diagram, and the high tide is points A and C. And point A is high tide because the water is closer to the moon. And point C is high tide because what's happening there is the Earth is closer than the water at point C, and it's shifting slightly toward the moon. And that's causing the water, in effect, to rise at point C and cause a tide. Other factors that affect tides, the moon's distance from Earth, as we've seen, it varies from about 220 to 250,000 miles approximately, from perigee to apogee. Perigee is when it's closest, apogee when it's farthest, and that can exert, here's one of those variables that need to be factored into the analysis here. That will have some effect on tides as well. The syzygy, the tides are most pronounced at new moon and full moon because of the alignment of the sun and the moon, kind of exaggerates the effect of the tides. Geology greatly affects tides. One of the largest tidal differences from low to high is the Bay of Fundy in northeast Canada. There, the tidal differentiation, I think, is something like 56 feet, almost 60 feet from low tide to high tide. And why is that? It's because it's in a bay, and the effect of the tide is concentrated in that inlet to into these vast swings from low to high tide. There it is up near Newfoundland. And here's low tide. I guess that would be high tide. And here is low tide in the Bay of Fundy. Incredible difference. Okay, let's talk about Van Allen belts there and Aurora Borealis. I'm just going to take a minute or two to cover this. The Van Allen belts are belts that, let me show you a picture of them, that surround the Earth in two different regions. And these were theorized by James Van Allen, an astronomer at the University of Iowa, and they were discovered by the early U.S. and Russian spacecraft to actually exist. They surround the Earth, as we've seen in that picture, containing charged particles, primarily electrons and protons, that are trapped from the solar wind, which are those free electrons that are emitted by the sun that we'll discuss in more detail in a later chapter. But the key thing to remember is there are charged particles in those Van Allen belts that have been captured by the Earth's magnetic field from the solar wind that's being emanated from the sun. And many of these particles, this is a key point, follow the Earth's magnetic field lines and flow in those directions. And that is essentially what causes the aurora borealis, which are always more intense and visible at the poles because that's where the greater concentration of magnetic energy is. Here's a depiction of these magnetic field lines, and as those particles are flying past the Earth, charged particles from the sun, many of them are trapped by those field lines and come, like the top of an orange, come right down through those field lines, and the greater concentration would be at the poles, and that's why you see aurora in northern latitudes or very southerly latitudes in the southern hemisphere. Absolutely dramatic. Occasionally we see them this far south. I was photographing a galaxy a few years ago, and all of my images turned out to be red, although I didn't notice any aurora, so it was a very faint aurora. The sky still looked black to me, but when I processed those images, the background kind of looked like this. And, of course, these are not static. They're constantly moving, like moving curtains. It is just an absolutely dramatic thing to see. Okay, so let's take a look at the moon. When you first look at it, and when you look at it as a full moon like this picture I took last year, just a very short 500th of a second image, you don't really see any detail with a full moon. Full moon is not the time you want to look through a telescope at the moon because you can't see anything. So, you can barely detect a few craters. You can see the maria, the seas, these black areas, which the ancients, and really up until the invention of the telescope, thought that they might be some type of a sea. That's why they were called maria. But you really don't see any detail when the moon is at this phase. People think that when the moon is full, that's the best time to view it. Absolutely nothing could be further from the truth. When it's like first or third quarter phase, it'll be first quarter in just a few days. That's the best time to view it because the shadows are their best, and they really make the crater stand out with incredible detail. And you can actually measure the length of the shadows of certain craters and certain obelisks that you'll see on the surface of the moon. You'll see that when you come out to my house for an observing session. So you have the Maria. As we've seen, the moon has a synchronous kind of locked rotation with the same side always facing the Earth. Is it a crystalline sphere, as Aristotle believed and many following him? Well, that was one of the great shocks that Galileo had when he turned his crude telescope toward the moon and discovered that it was not a smooth crystalline orb, but rather was filled with countless craters. It was imperfect. This was part of the downfall of the Ptolemaic geocentric system. Look at the lunar surface. This is the far side of the moon on the left. The most conspicuous feature that we see are the craters. What caused them? That was a controversy in astronomy for many, many years. The two theories were impacts or volcanoes. Today, the predominant model is those craters are impact structures largely, with a few exceptions. A small minority might be volcanic in nature, but the overwhelming majority of those craters were based on impacts. One of the main reasons that scientists have come up with this conclusion is the ray structures that we see in the newer craters that have not been, you know, overtaken by subsequent cratering that have destroyed the ray structure. So we look at this crater right here, for example. We can clearly see rays, which are what? Ejecta from the collision event. And crater erosion is often used as a dating technique. You look at ejecta. Do you see it? Don't you see it? How thick, how visible, how defined is it? That's one of the ways that astrogeologists have dated certain objects in our solar system. But here is an excellent example of what we're talking about. And by the way, as you look at the craters, and when you look at my telescope in my house, you'll see all kinds of craters. Craters down to just maybe 5 to 10 miles in diameter. And you'll see craters that are 100 miles in diameter. You'll see obelisks. You'll see walls. It's just a very geologically interesting through a telescope. You'll see ejecta. But you don't see ejecta on all of these craters because of the erosion that occurs because of the process of other future impactors. Those maria, those seas, are thought to be lava from ancient volcanoes that have flooded the surface in those regions. You see a few here, but mostly on our side of the moon, those dark areas, much more prominent on the side of the moon facing us than on the far side. Okay, let's take a look at the two basic kinds of crater. You have the simple crater and the complex crater. That's the basic division. Each one of these has many subcategories, but that's the basic idea that I want you to be aware of. And we'll see many examples of these through my telescope, hundreds of examples. One thing that we do know is that comets and asteroids strike the moon at incredible velocities of up 20 miles per second or faster. And current modeling, computer modeling, has shown that this velocity will produce a crater 10 to 20 times larger in diameter than the impactor itself. Simple craters are the most common craters, under 12 miles in diameter. And we see an example of a simple crater here, less than 12 miles in diameter, and there's no internal structure there. Whereas larger craters are more complex, and they have a central uplift, or peak, as it's called. Craters 12 to 100 miles in diameter tend to be complex with a single peak, whereas craters greater than 100 miles in diameter are complex craters with a ring-shaped uplifts instead of a central peak. So the thing to look for, and when we look at lunar images, or when you look through a telescope at the moon, the larger the crater, the more likely it's going to have some central object, and it will be a peak if the crater is in the 12 to 100 mile diameter range, but it tends to be more complex as the crater reaches the 100 mile diameter or larger. Mike? Largely, it's thought to be because of gravity. You know, initially, it probably was a central peak, but over eons of time, the thing just crumbles, just like a building on Earth. And because of the weight of it, it's so large, you have basically an obelisk sticking up from the middle of a 150-mile crater. That's going to eventually collapse down, and that forms a more complex ring-shaped structure. Here's some examples. At the top, this would be a simple crater. There's no central architecture of any kind. There's no peak. There's no ring structure. Whereas this is a large, complex crater. And as you can see, each one of these here would be simple craters. But look at this. Here's an example of that ring-shaped structure. So we know that that is a large crater. And you see these terraces here on the edge of the crater wall? You'll see examples of that through my telescope on large craters. What do you think that consists of? That consists of the geological decay of the crater wall. Just like the central peak collapsed, those sheer crater walls tend to collapse over time as well and form this terrace look.
What causes erosion?
Eons of time with micrometeorite impacts, smaller meteorite impacts, the force of gravity impacting it. But keep in mind, the reason we don't see, and hey, the Earth has been vastly more geologically active than the moon over the same period of time. The reason that we don't see a cratered surface on the Earth is because erosion eliminates the craters. Storms, volcanoes, earthquakes, wind, hurricanes, tornadoes, etc., vegetation. So there is erosion on the moon, but it's very slow. And some of it is caused by gravity, and that's what we see right here with the terracing effect on the rims of these larger craters. And the central peak, this was probably like an obelisk initially. And gravity over time has just pulled that. There's no wind to blow it over. Here's another good example of a complex crater, and again, look at that ring structure there in the middle. You call it a ring structure. It's basically the remnants of a central peak that has collapsed. And that's because it's so large, because the crater is so large, over 100 miles in diameter. Look at the terracing here we see very clearly. So this used to be a very high, sheer cliff, but gravity is just pulling it down, just like you see in the Western Rockies. You know, many examples of features, geological features, where, you know, you see the effects of gravity on those features over long periods of time. Here's a perfect example of a complex crater with a central peak. This is on one of the moons of Saturn that we'll look at in the following chapter. But it's interesting to look at craters on other objects in the solar system beyond our moon. Here we see a moon of Saturn a billion miles away. It's interesting to look at that. You don't really see any clear terracing there, do you, as you did on the lunar complex craters? The question is, has NASA seen anything impact the moon recently? The only example is highly contested. A teenager in Oklahoma in the 1950s claimed that he saw an impact on the moon through a crude homemade telescope. There is the verdict still out as to whether he did. He saw what he claimed to be a flash and like smoke debris, you know, dust, you would call it. But whether he in fact saw that or not, there's a lot of skepticism as to whether he actually did. But hey, you look at the moon over an extended period of time, and there's always the possibility you're going to see something. But keep in mind, it's highly unlikely in the sense that why would it not have impacted the Earth as opposed to the moon? We have so much greater. We're 50 times greater in terms of mass. The gravitational attraction of the Earth would be so much greater. Why would some object far in space be impacting the moon as opposed to the Earth? on its approach? I mean, that's the question. And, of course, as we'll see in the next chapter, Jupiter is just like a giant vacuum sucking up all kinds of debris and really protecting the Earth from impacts. Okay, good. We can get started the last few minutes looking at the planet Mercury. Again, looking at our schematic diagram here showing the relative sizes of the terrestrial planets. It is 38% the diameter of the Earth and about 6% of the volume of the Earth. It's an inferior planet, which means it is closer to the Sun than we are, so it goes through phases just like the Moon, just like Venus. Classic proof of the heliocentric model of the solar system. A day on Mercury is 59 Earth days, going from point A over here to point E to make one full rotation, whereas 1 year on Mercury is 88 Earth days, and that's going from A all the way around to A. The temperature differential on the surface of Mercury ranges from minus 280 degrees Fahrenheit to 800 degrees Fahrenheit, depending on whether you're in the sun or not. It has a very low albedo. The albedo refers to the reflectivity, which is usually associated with cloud cover. The gas giants, as we'll see, have a very high albedo reflectivity, but these rocky terrestrial planets generally do not. Now, Earth's an exception because we have water and we have clouds, which give us a rather high albedo. But Mercury has an albedo of only about 10%. The first flyby Mercury by any Earth-based spacecraft was Mariner 19 in 1974, which flew by and took these images. A very thin sodium atmosphere was actually detected in 2000. Of course, the reason that these terrestrial planets lack an atmosphere is because they don't have the mass to retain gravitationally most gases. And that's why the gas giants have retained such thick atmospheres, because they're so much more massive and the gas does not dissipate. Heavily cratered surface. However, upon close examination, it's interesting, it's been noted for many centuries that the craters on Mercury are different from the moon than our moon's craters in a couple of important respects. They tend to be shallower, not as deep as the lunar craters, and the rims are lower or smaller. Why is that? Maybe erosion by micrometeorites. Do you know that the Earth is impacted by billions of meteors every day in the form of micrometeorites? How many of you have a car that's kind of a dark color? How many of you have a car? Okay, here's what you do. Look at, you know, have a friend with a dark colored car. Doesn't have to be black. It can be dark blue, dark red or something. Get it washed. Or find one in the parking lot that's clean, and ideally have it washed, let's say, in the evening, and then look at it the next morning. And what are you going to find covering that vehicle? A thin layer of dust. You know where that comes from? That's micrometeorite dust from space. It's the remnants of meteorites that have disintegrated in the upper atmosphere overnight and have gently drifted downward onto the surface of the Earth. Some of those micrometeorites on a planet like Mercury with no atmosphere, they don't disintegrate in the upper atmosphere. There isn't an atmosphere. So they impact the Earth. It's just constant bombardment of, like being shot at with BB guns constantly. A hotter, softer surface perhaps at the time of impact may have resulted in those smaller, shallower craters. These are some of the theories. A greater surface gravity on Mercury than the Moon, which tends to pull those craters' rims down and those central peaks down faster than happens on a much smaller surface like the Moon. Maybe lava flows from the very hot interior of this planet covered the crater floors. I mean, there have been a number of theories to explain why the craters are different. The current model indicates that those craters on Mercury were, most of them, like the Moon, formed by impacts. Mercury goes around the Sun once every 88 days. Why don't we see transits? A transit is where we can actually see the disk of the planet go across the sun in its orbit around the sun. Why don't we see that happen at least once every 88 days? That's how long it takes to make one trajectory around the sun. And the reason, of course, is that it's not on a perfect, it's not coplanar with the sun and the Earth. It's off by a few degrees, which is enough for that transit to be a relatively rare event. We just had a transit last year of Mercury. Messenger spacecraft was launched in 2004. It arrives in 2008. It will orbit Mercury and do a number of scientific experiments plus imaging. Here's a couple of the best images of the surface of Mercury. And again, look at those craters. We see some with evidence of ejecta there. But as you'll notice, the craters tend to be shallower, shorter walls than we saw on the moon. There's that messenger spacecraft and artist conception in orbit around Mercury. Okay, let's go ahead and resume with Venus. Venus, as it turns out, is the planet that comes closest to the Earth. At its closest, it is probably 25 to 27 million miles away, compared to Mars, which is the second closest planet, which at its very closest is 35 to 40 million miles away. This is a picture I took a few years ago of Venus, and what you see immediately is that it's not a full phase of the planet. We see a partial phase here, a gibbous phase. And as Galileo discovered, Venus, and here's a Hubble Space image, Hubble Space Telescope image, showing even some of the cloud layers on top of the thick atmosphere. Those clouds, by the way, are on top of the atmosphere. They're not part of the atmosphere, as we'll see. But again, you see a phase, and that's, you know, what should you remember about Venus is that it's an inferior planet, meaning it's closer to the sun than the Earth, and as a result, it goes through phases. We never, well, we occasionally see it full when it's on the far side of the sun, but it's much smaller in that orientation. This diagram, I think, illustrates it well. It illustrates a couple of things. Venus is closer to the sun than the Earth, and it's an inferior planet, and so we never see it go arc across the entire sky, like the like Jupiter or Mars would, for example. It never comes out here. It's not orbiting around the sun where we can see it in all phases, at all points in the sky. In fact, as it turns out, Venus never rises more than 48 degrees in the sky. That's called opposition, or greatest eastern elongation. And then it starts going back down again. How can that be explained in a geocentric theory? It can't. And then Galileo discovered that Venus goes through phases. And here it's full when it's on the far side of the sun. When it's on the near side, these are both syzygy points. When it's on the near side of the sun, on a line with the Earth, it's kind of in the new phase. We don't see any planet there at all. But when it's at these other phases, the gibbous phases, we see portions of the planet illuminated. And the portion illuminated gets smaller and smaller as the planet gets closer and closer to the Earth. See, here is where it's at its closest to the Earth in this configuration. And in that configuration, we can't see any portion of the planet illuminated. So as you move slightly away from the new phase, you get into the small crescent phase, and that's when we begin to see it. And it's interesting, that's when Venus appears brightest in the sky, when it's a thin crescent. Why is that? Because at the crescent phase, it's so much closer to the Earth. So back here, Venus is much farther away from us, but it's full, and yet it seems much dimmer than it does here, because here it's tens of millions of miles closer to the Earth, even though maybe 10 or 20% of the surface is being illuminated. Here's some of the physical data for Venus, and this is a good diagram showing the relative sizes of the planets of the Earth and Venus, and we look at the physical data down here. Venus has a diameter 95% that of the Earth. Its mass is 82% of the Earth. Its volume is about 85%. Its distance, about 72% of the way from the Sun to the Earth. 1 year, 226 days. 1 day is minus 243 Earth days. What do you mean, minus 243 Earth days? Venus is an example of a planet with a retrograde orbital rotation. All planets in the solar system orbit about the Sun in a counterclockwise direction. All eight planets. If you were somehow on the north pole of the Sun looking down at the solar system, all the planets would be moving in a counterclockwise direction. And six of the planets would be orbiting about their axis in a counterclockwise direction. There are two exceptions to that rule, Venus and Neptune. Now, it's called prograde when a planet is spinning about its orbit in the same, spinning about its axis in the same direction as it's going around the Sun. It's called retrograde motion, where a planet's orbital rotation is clockwise as opposed to its counterclockwise orbital motion around the Sun. And that's why this is minus 243 Earth days. Venus has no moons, but this is a good description here of the relative sizes of the planets. That's a radar image, by the way, showing some surface features. None of the surface, of course, of Venus can be seen because of the thick cloud layer. Okay, it's often referred to as the morning star, sometimes as the evening star, because you see it, since it's an inferior planet, it's always close to the Sun. That means we see it right after sunset or right before sunup, depending on its orientation in its orbit and the Earth's orbit about the Sun. As I said, its maximum elevation in the sky is only about 45 degrees, 48 degrees. So if you see some bright object straight overhead, you immediately know that can't be Venus, because Venus can never go higher than about half the distance from the horizon to zenith straight overhead. The atmosphere of Venus is about 96% carbon dioxide compared to less than 1% on Earth. It is still considered a sister planet because of how similar it is in terms of mass and volume and diameter. Atmospheric pressure is about 90 times what we have on the surface of the Earth. The clouds on top of that thick atmosphere, those wispy white clouds that we saw, are actually now known to be droplets of sulfuric acid. 2% of the sunlight reaches the surface of Venus, which still is enough to provide a fair amount of illumination when 98% of the sun, of our Sun, is eclipsed by the Moon. It's still broad daylight. Venus has no moons. Astronomers believe that it only has one plate, so it doesn't have multiple surface plates as we do on Earth. And because it has just one plate, there's very little evidence, and this is the reason why it's assumed to have just the one plate, is because of the lack of any evidence of volcanoes or quakes. There are several large craters, but no small ones, and for obvious reasons. Smaller meteoroids are going to burn up in that thick atmosphere long before they reach the surface. No magnetic field has been detected. Average surface temperature, 900 degrees Fahrenheit, both day and night. It's the hottest planet in the solar system. It's hotter than Mercury, which is much closer to the Sun. How in the world can that be? It's what's called a runaway greenhouse effect. Just like your car parked in a parking lot in the summer. Doesn't it seem hot when you get in the car? That is the same process that is happening on the surface of Venus. I'll show you a diagram of it here in a minute. But there have been a number of unmanned missions to Venus over the years. The Soviet Union sent up several. This was the first soft lander that took color photographs and black and white photographs on the surface of Venus, the Venera 13, which soft landed in 1982. Kind of an amazing picture when you think about it. There in the foreground is the lens cap of the camera that fell off. So just imagine what you're looking at there is a desolate landscape, a planet almost exactly the same size as ours, only 25 million miles closer to the Sun. And yet, what we're looking at here is a desolate horizon, an average daytime or nighttime temperature of 900, almost 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit, hotter you know, hot enough to melt lead. Will there ever be a manned landing there? Why would we want to? Here's the greenhouse effect. Most of the light that comes to us from the sun, most of the visible light, is actually reflected off the layer of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere, which consists of not just the clouds, but there's also a layer of carbon dioxide. The sunlight comes down, and most of that visible light, most of the light from the sun, is reflected off that cloud layer. Some of it, though, penetrates. It's not a 100% reflectivity. Some of it penetrates through the cloud layer on Venus, and it is absorbed by the ground. This is exactly what happens on Earth, by the way. And then it's re-emitted as infrared radiation because it heats up the ground. And anytime you have heat, you have infrared radiation. And so it's reflected as infrared radiation. The infrared radiation, the CO2, the carbon dioxide, is opaque to infrared radiation. So the infrared radiation that is developed has no place to escape, and it's retained below the cloud layer, and it just continues to heat up hotter and hotter. The energy is trapped, increasing the surface temperature. Why? We have a similar process taking place on Earth. In fact, if it weren't for the limited greenhouse effect that we have, which is a natural effect, the average daytime temperature on Earth would be an estimated 50 degrees Fahrenheit cooler than it is now. The average daytime temperature on Earth is 45 degrees Fahrenheit, at all, you know, taking all things into consideration, all latitudes, all seasons, etc. That's the average temperature of Earth. How would you like to have an average temperature of minus 5 degrees Fahrenheit? So, thankfully, the greenhouse effect thus far has been beneficial to human life. Now, why do we not have a runaway greenhouse effect on Earth and produce another Venus that is totally inhospitable? Here are the main reasons. Number one is recycling. Rain on Earth dissolves some of that carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Plus, we have photosynthesis, where plants are converting some of that CO2 into oxygen. And limestone deposits capture a lot. We have more CO2 in limestone than we do in the atmosphere. On Venus, there's no liquid water. There's no rain. There are no oceans to help dissipate that effect. Recent evidence suggests that carbon dioxide levels on Earth are increasing and global temperature is increasing. But is this the beginning of a runaway greenhouse effect? Here's some of the contraindications. As the heat does rise, we have what? We're going to have more evaporation of water. More evaporation of water is going to produce more clouds. That's going to result in a reduced temperature. Evidence indicates that it's been much hotter in the past with no runaway greenhouse effect developing on Earth. It's a controversial issue today, whether the Earth is warming. It's indisputable that the Earth is warming. The question is that part of a natural cycle that has happened many times before? And we just are on the upswing of that cycle now, and it will plateau and head back down. We can't say. Is it the burning of fossil fuels that has produced this? Many think that the answer to that is yes. Some say no. I would say the preponderance of scientists would argue that the evidence is convincing that there is fossil fuel caused increase in the greenhouse, not the greenhouse effect, but in carbon dioxide levels increasing in the atmosphere that's resulting in higher surface temperatures. I think that is probably the consensus. But again, we don't know, because when you look back historically, there have been periods of time dating back millions, hundreds of millions of years, where it's clear that the temperature was greater. The North Pole was a tropic, a tropical area at one time in the Earth's history, for example. But I think a lot of scientists have said this. If it's reasonably likely that fossil fuels are causing the Earth's temperature to increase, then if there's at least a reasonable possibility of that, should we not be taking action today to avoid that catastrophe? Because if it is true, and we don't do anything, thinking the proof is not sufficient, we may lose valuable years of time to react. Question. Yes, the greenhouse effect is happening now. And as I said, without the greenhouse effect, life would be impossible here. We're here because of the greenhouse effect, propping up our temperature, our average daytime temperature, about 50 degrees on the surface of the planet, taking away fossil fuels from the equation. I'm doing my part. I drive a Prius, zero-emission vehicle. Any other questions on this? Here's an example of the greenhouse effect in your automobile in the parking in a parking lot in the summer in Texas. You know, the sunlight is able to penetrate through the glass of your car, and what does it do when it hits the upholstery in the car, the seats and the dashboard? It increases that temperature, producing infrared radiation. That infrared radiation, the glass is opaque to it, and it can't escape. Here's a radar image of the surface of Venus, 900 degrees. Okay, let's move on to the next closest planet to the Earth, and that's Mars, the red planet. Here's the physical data. Look at the comparison of Earth and Mars, much smaller than Venus. Here's the physical data. It's only about half the diameter. And about 11% the mass, 15% the volume, that's 4/3 times pi r cubed. Distance 1.52 times farther from the sun than the Earth is. So it's averages about 140 million miles, as I recall, as opposed to the Earth, 93 million miles. 1 year on Mars is equal to 1.9 Earth years. 1 day is 1.03 Earth days. A day, one period of rotation about its axis of the planet Mars is almost identical to the Earth. And I saw this happen firsthand in August of 2003 when Mars was at its closest point to Earth in tens of thousands of years and closer than it will be for many, many thousands of years into the future. I think astronomers calculated it hadn't been that close in over 50,000 years. But with the day 1.03, I was out in the driveway just learning how to take pictures with my telescope, and I decided to try to take pictures of Mars. And it was interesting to me, looking at that planet from night to night, I saw the same features. It looked exactly the same from night to night, unlike Jupiter, where if you see the great red spot one night, you can rest assured it's not going to be there the next night, because it rotates once every 10 hours. So the differential between its rotation and ours is very different. You're not going to see the same thing every night. Mars is different. It has almost the same rotational speed as the Earth. And so from night to night, for many nights, you're going to see the same essential surface patterns. It has two moons, Phobos and Deimos, who were the sons of Ares, the Greek name for Mars, the Latin name for the god of war. His two sons, Phobos and Deimos, who accompanied Mars into battle, are the names for, their names are translated terror and fear, the companions of the god of war. These moons, by the way, are quite small. They have a semi-major axis only of a major axis probably in the 10 to 15 mile range. And they're very irregular, as we'll see. Mars' closest approach is 35 million. 1 day, 24, a little bit less than 24.5 Earth days. 1 year, about 2 Earth years. It has a 25-degree axial tilt, so it's tilted 25 degrees to the plane of the Earth and Sun, which is almost exactly the same as ours, 23.5 degrees. So the seasons there would be similar to Earth, not in terms of the temperature, but in terms of the four seasons throughout the year in most areas of the planet. Those seasons are visible to amateur astronomers. You can see the polar caps sometimes during the year. I've seen them in a 5-inch telescope. I've seen the canals, the vegetation. For many years people thought were. I mean, it is amazing to see these green blotches that change their shape over the course of several nights. and weeks. The orbital radius averages about 140 million miles. That's its distance from the sun. So the diameter of its orbit would be about 280 million miles. Temperature range of negative 220 degrees Fahrenheit to 70 degrees Fahrenheit. Man, that sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Distance from Earth averages 35 to 230 million miles, depending on our orientation to Mars in our orbit. Atmosphere, it does have an atmosphere. It's thin. It's been determined to be 95% carbon dioxide. Surface pressure, there is a surface pressure, but it's only about 1% what we have here on planet Earth. And that's one of the main reasons we don't expect and don't see any water. We see evidence of water in the past, as I'll show you some images, of water basins, river basins. But water would boil away with a surface pressure that low. If you're in space, water boils away instantly because there's no pressure to keep the water from escaping as steam. Whereas the more and more surface pressure you have, the higher and higher the boiling point of water becomes. So the boiling point of water at sea level is different from on the at the top of a 10,000-foot mountain. And those of you that have gone camping have experienced that. It gets easier and easier to boil water the higher you go. When you get into space, it boils away automatically. You go to the top of Mount Everest, for example. Main topographical features are the polar caps on both poles. I'll show you an image of one here in a minute. Volcanoes, the largest, most active volcano in the solar system is on Mars. Olympus Mons, it's larger than the state of Arizona. Three times higher than Mount Everest on a planet, 15% as big. This is an extraordinary feature. Canyons, huge canyons that make the Grand Canyon look small. Great rifts that seem to be ripping the planet in half. Terraces, dust storms, evidence of water in the past. Olympus Mons or Mount Olympus, 75,000 feet. I say three times, closer to two times the height of Everest. It actually has lower surface gravity at the top, than as you would expect, than it does at the base. We'll look at that in a future chapter when we talk about gravitational time dilation. That time slows down the faster you're moving and your proximity to greater gravitational force. So what that means is this. Experiments have been done at Harvard University years ago, a famous experiment. Atomic clocks, one on the third floor of a science building, one on the first floor. The clock on the first floor was slower than the clock on the third floor because it was closer to the center of the Earth. Not by much, but it was. And because of that greater proximity to gravity, there was a noticeable time dilation. Time was slower for the clock in the first floor than on the third floor. That's why I've always suggested to students, always occupy the ground floor of the dormitory, not the top floors. You'll age more slowly. That's one of the corollaries, one of the aspects of Einstein's general theory of relativity, gravitational time dilation. We'll return to that topic in a future chapter. But we see it here on Mount Olympus. Do you know that we currently have four unmanned spacecraft orbiting around Mars? And we have two rovers running around the surface of the planet that were supposed to have died over a year ago? And in fact, for a period of time, after they landed, we were not making any contact with them. Oh, man, have we just lost hundreds of millions of dollars? Wasted. And there was a very famous cartoon, I think it was in the New York Times, shortly after this happened, of a picture of the display panel inside these rovers with a window screen with the message, hit any key. Is there life on Mars? No evidence of life on Mars. We'll come back to that topic in a later chapter. You recognize this gentleman? Probably not. Schiaparelli was an Italian astronomer who had a large refracting telescope and observed Mars. This is a modern image. He never saw it this clear. But over the course of a number of years, he carefully not only observed Mars on many, many, many nights, but he began drawing what he considered to be a series of channels on the surface of the planet. Now, the word channel, as it turns out, in Italian, is canale. And, well, once the English-speaking press found out that there were canali on the surface of Mars, as far as they were concerned, that meant canals, and canals meant intelligent beings. And he launched a cottage industry of predicting the existence of intelligent life on the surface of Mars. We'll return to that topic in a later chapter. His interest was picked up by the American industrialist turned astronomer, Percival Lowell, who built the Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona, which is still operational. And here he is at his large refracting telescope, I think it was about 24 inches, with which he observed Mars for years of time. And he also took detailed drawings, beginning to think that he was seeing canals. And in fact, he came up with the theory that what these canals were in fact canals. Now you see at the top of this image, the North Polar ice cap, and he concluded that the Martians in the equator were in an equatorial, very arid region of the planet. And they were dying of starvation because of the drought until they built this massive canal structure that brought water from the polar cap down to the equatorial regions and from the southern polar cap upward. He writes a book, Mars and Its Canals, becomes a bestseller, describing this network of canals on the surface of Mars. Here's one of his diagrams. Now, high-resolution modern-day images, as you can see, we don't see any evidence for canals. But this is what Percival Lowell had in mind, that we would see someday if we put a lander on the surface of Mars. Habitations along the canals. Well, reality turned out to be something less romantic. Here we see the Mariner 4 spacecraft launched by NASA in 1964 that was a flyby. Now, keep in mind, this would be the equivalent of going past an object faster than a bullet, taking a few pictures of it as you go by. That was a flyby, not an orbiter. Okay, if we could put a spaceship in orbit around Mars, you could leisurely take however many pictures you want. High magnification, high quality images, high resolution. But that was not true for the initial unmanned spacecraft. These were just bullets that we were shooting past Mars and snapping a few pictures. Let me show you the first picture that was taken by Mariner 4. This was the first image sent back to Earth, 1964, indicating what the surface of Mars looked like. NASA scientists waited with anticipation at what these pictures were going to reveal. Are there canals there? Are there habitations, settlements, communities of intelligent life? Here's what they saw. One of the first images of Mars. And what do you immediately see? Craters. Kind of similar to the moon in some ways, or Mercury, isn't it? But no evidence of water, canals. And this was in one of the areas that looked greener than others, where it was assumed that there might be vegetation. Here was the Mariner 6, 5 years later, much higher resolution image. Very desolate. Interesting to note, like Mercury, how shallow those craters are. Probably because of the greater mass of the planet than our moon, for example. Now here, in 1971, was Mariner 9, which was the first orbiter where we actually put a spaceship in unmanned in orbit around Mars, taking numerous pictures. This was taken of one of the polar caps, as I recall. This was, again, a polar area. But as you can see, a little higher resolution than what we've seen before. Then, in 1976, we had a lander, the Viking lander, that actually landed on the surface of Mars and took these awesome pictures. One of the first images taken from the surface of Mars. What a feat of science, you know, to launch a spacecraft, have it travel 50 or so million miles, put it in orbit around another planet and then have it soft land through the atmosphere on the surface and then start taking pictures, which it transmits back to Earth. Absolutely amazing. These are, again, are some of those initial photos. There's its antenna. Now, today, we have, as I say, four unmanned spaceships in orbit around Mars, including the Mars Global Surveyor. Here are some of its picture images. These were just taken in the last couple of years. There's that great rift or canyon I was mentioning before. This seems to be ripping the planet in half. Look at the volcanoes over here. Ancient volcanoes, all these black areas. Not many craters. Another view on the other side of the planet. Right here is Olympus Mons, Mount Olympus, the largest volcano in the solar system. There are the two moons, Deimos and Phobos, only 10 or 15 miles in diameter. They're very irregularly shaped because, you know, why is your laptop computer not a perfect sphere? I mean, when you wake up tomorrow, what if you see your laptop, it's reconfigured itself as a perfect sphere? It can't do that because it's not massive enough. But the more mass an object has, the more its equilibrium state is going to be a perfect sphere. And that's why larger objects in space tend to be spherical, smaller ones more irregular. They don't have the gravity to conform to that spherical shape. Here's Mount Olympus Mons right here, 75,000 feet high. It's dormant, but you can clearly see the evidence of the former volcanic activity. Terracing, this is some of the evidence of formerly running water. And again, planetary geologists were able to look at this kind of data and compare it to similar phenomena that occur on Earth. These are some of the evidences for previous liquid water. Additional evidence here, tributaries. Looks like an ancient river channel right here. This is about 100 kilometers, 60 miles, the key there. But you can just see how this breaking into these tributaries here at this juncture is very similar to what we would see on Earth. Now, those two rovers that are still functioning on the surface of Mars, here's an artist's conception of what they look like. I think they were, at the time, were the most expensive vehicles ever constructed. Here is a picture they took of sunrise on the Martian plain. Isn't that awesome? The surface, and compare the clarity of the resolution in these images with those images of the Viking back in 1976. Hey, those were great, but this is a much higher resolution and much wider angle camera. This is part of the rover right here. Look at the resolution of those rocks. Okay,